gonna see some serious shit.
Nolan and Bale are like those guys because they spend so much time in the States, like somehow to alternate.
I've always wondered how that happened. Like, Nolan kept going back and forth. Like, what, did his parents split up as a kid or something? I was always fascinated by that story because he kept going back and forth.
Okay. I don't think Bale knows what his accent is. I think he knows least of all.
Hey, Gary Oldman's done so many, but he's always been able to maintain his own voice.
Well, I mean, Bale is like, he is a flat out, he's a Welshman. Yeah, I mean, that's his thing. But Nolan,
it's
like, I've never...
sounds like a Cockney.
Wait, who's got the Cockney accent, Bale or Nolan?
Bale. Well, I thought it would be a good idea to play Batman. He doesn't sound like
Bale's...
Timothy Dalton or something. Like, he's not
boss. No, but Bale's got it. Bale is actually one of them. Like, everyone
Bale
said,
thought
like,
it would be a good idea to play a Batman, you know. This doesn't sound like that. That's what a Welshman sounds like. A bad Welshman.
That would have been, yeah, that was a different take from Batman Begins. Like, what the hell are you? I'm Batman.
What the fuck?
Francis McDermott
okay,
is
okay,
Batman.
Okay, it's time.
Batman.
We're doing this
Francis
show now.
Francis McDermott
no
is Batman.
A Minnesota Batman.
Yeah, I got a big statue of
him. Nice court.
This is about to go off.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to a very special episode of Movie Mode. It's special because I am delighted to say the old gang is back. Before I introduce them, my name is Phil G, the English gentleman at your service, and before we start the introductions, actually, I will answer that question that I've gotten hundreds of emails about this week and that you all want to know. Yes, I am in those photos with Prince Harry. I'm not at liberty to say which one I am. All I'll say is that look at the one with the best body and the one that's the most well hung, and then look at the woman next to him. That's me. I mean, and also,
say Phil, you were in great shape in those photos.
Thank you very much. We just went there to look at the museums. I mean, and we got all this fuss. I think he's being judged. I don't think it's.
See, you made a mistake. Las Vegas has no museums.
That was the joke. Oh, well, yes.
Actually, no. Phil was looking for the Willard White House is what happened.
You mean the Paul Rubens Museum? What are you talking about?
No, that's a Diamonds Are Forever joke.
Whoops, my mistake. I thought you were talking about Fred Willard.
Who is in those photos, by the way?
Oh, no.
Also joining us is a Skype enemy number one, builder of houses for the poor, and Harry's very embarrassed grandmother. It's Queen Christina.
Hi. I really don't think that story is a big deal. He didn't break any laws. He didn't hurt anybody. He got naked in a hotel room with a consenting group of girls. Who cares?
Exactly. And you know what I was saying to my friends this week? Honestly, if there was a photo of him fully clothed, kicking a bellboy to the ground because he got his food order wrong, there wouldn't be as much fuss. That would be just seen as, oh, that's normal.
Okay, well, here's the thing, though. He's a kid. He's 26, 27. He's not married. I mean, like, that's the thing. It's like, if he was, like, had a wife and shit, and here he is, like, fucking around in Las Vegas, that's a big deal. But he's not his dad. He's not committed to somebody and then fucking behind their back. Big fucking whoop.
It's still better than the time when he dressed in that Hitler outfit.
That's true, actually.
Okay, and that voice you just
hit.
Joining us is the man who only joins us when the subjects covered are worthy of him, so we know we're onto a good show when he does come. It's Captain N. Hocken.
Oh, come on now, Phil. Yes, I'm back here again for this special edition of the show, and again, it's nice to be back.
And we are also delighted to say we are joined by the final member of our Movie Moan family back from 2010. If you remember those old shows, they were some of my favourites because I was just, I mean, I love what we're doing now, but the chemistry that us guys had, all five of us back then, the Team Force 5 Movie Moan gang, it was just the best, and I'm so glad he's here. Will you please welcome the guy we always have on when we want to add a little gravitas to the show? You know, Star Wars had Alec Guinness, X-Men had Ian McKellen, Movie Moan has Mr. Lou Sitzmer. Hello, Lou.
Yes, it's time for a little old fogetry again.
Oh, we can't wait.
After my Avengers venting, I was surprised that you guys asked me back on again.
Thank you for having a different opinion.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
And finally joining us is the guy who I was reminded this week. I was listening back to some of our older 2010 shows, some of my favourites. The amount of sentences that he let me finish completely, I could count on one hand. But it's only because he had something funnier to say than me. It's Mr. Jamie Williams.
Hello.
Hello. So, it's come to that awful time of the year known as the Dead Zone. It's a barren, desolate place where no interesting news exists and no decent films come out. Or what constitutes a decent film is the remake of Judge Dredd. So it's a pretty sucky time to be doing a weekly podcast about films. But we've come up with a few ways to kill the time, and this week it occurred to me to do something that hasn't been done on the Movie Moan podcast before, well, certainly not in its current incarnation. Tonight, we are going to run down each our top five favourite films. Jamie and I did this back in 2008, I seem to remember, when we were still doing it as a live show. But 4 years is a long time. And I don't know about anyone else out there, but my list is always in a state of flux. There's always films moving places on the list. Number one never changes. I don't think anybody's favourite film, if you have one, ever really changes. It's something that's very deeply personal to you, but we're going to find out tonight. You know, we're each going to take a turn, counting down from 5 to 1 with our favourite films ever. We have not discussed this, we haven't talked about it. I have a few inklings, but none of us really know what the others have picked. And as Bane might say, the identity of the films is a mystery. So, I love that bit. I love that. That's one of my favourite lines. Let's just get to it. Christina, what is your number five?
My number five is The Shawshank Redemption. I love this movie so much. I have nothing bad to say about this film. Anyone who has anything bad to say about this film can go swim in a river of shit. Because this movie is awesome. It makes me feel so happy every single time I watch it. And that final shot of them on the beach hugging, it just kills me every single time. I love that movie.
It's amazing to look back at. We talk about, like, we talk about box office on the show frequently. And it's actually a film that kind of, like, with It's a Wonderful Life and a couple number of others, where it was a failure when it came out. and people discovered it on home video and through television, and I don't know if it's prevalent as prevalent now, but there was a period where it was on every weekend on a Turner station, whether it be TBS or TNT. One of those two was going to have it. I don't know if they have it anymore. I think AMC plays it a lot now. But it was hard not to find it on television. And I can remember a few times actually going to the video store and hearing I swear to God, I heard teenage girls, the well-kept ones, you know, what's the phrase that they use for it? High-maintenance girls. Looking through videos and saying, oh, it's The Shawshank Redemption. I love that movie. Like, how many movies can you hear, like, so many different kind of people say they love with that? It's rare, man.
Jamie, I take it it's on your five somewhere. Am I right about that?
It was very back and forth. No, it's not. It was hard for me to decide. Last time we did the list, it was number one, actually, but... It was excruciating to pick five movies, and it kept staying on the list and getting off the list, and it's not on my list.
Well, what is your number five, sir?
Number five for me, it's interesting. I don't know. I'm very certain no one else has got this on the list, actually. It is George Romero's Dawn of the Dead from 1979. Incorrectly, this is 1978 in some places. I don't know why. But I saw this movie at – how old was I? Actually, the long version of what happened was – I was getting into horror movies, and I must have been around 10 years old, and I actually caught Night of the Living Dead, the original film from 1968, on late night. I couldn't go to sleep, so I turned on the television, and our new Fox station played it. Since that movie is public domain, anyone can make a copy and air it anytime they want to. It's on playing. The most terrifying movie I've ever seen. I couldn't believe it. I'm sure. Have you guys seen the original Night of the Living Dead?
Oh, yes.
It's still the scariest movie ever made, I think. And I literally guessed the ending. I'm sitting there going, oh, God, I hope those people don't think Ben's a zombie. And then the rednecks aim the gun right at his head and kill him. And it was still the middle of the night, and I had to go to bed. And needless to say, I couldn't sleep 2 hours earlier. It was even harder after the movie ended. But what my point being getting to is that I was getting into horror movies. I discovered there was a sequel to that movie. That Romero did a trilogy of films about a zombie holocaust. So the second movie was Dawn of the Dead. I grabbed the VHS copy from HBO Home Video, no less, and I sat and watched it. And, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is that film was the late 60s. This is the late 70s, so clearly there's color. But in the first 10 minutes of the movie, there is a SWAT raid in the projects of people who are keeping their dead loved ones, refusing to get rid of them, refusing to shoot their heads, and... In the first 10 minutes, there's a head explosion. You can imagine being a kid at 10 years old, circa 94, seeing this for the first time. My jaw was to the floor. I mean, this is the closest to a comic book movie that's on my list, but you realize, like, it's so... This movie is anarchy on screen. I mean, these people take over a shopping mall. There's, you know, zombies everywhere. I don't even know where to keep going with this movie. Have you guys seen Dawn of the Dead?
Of course. I think you summed it up, sir. It's anarchy incarnate. That's exactly what it is.
You think, like, if this really happened, people would be doing this. They would be taken off in whatever transportation they can to some safe haven. At one point in the movie, I think they're looking for – they're thinking, oh, well, Canada, they'll be okay. And they stop in Pittsburgh at this mall. I don't think it's clearly set in Pittsburgh, but if you know Romero, you know most of his movies up until last 10, 15 years. They're all shot in Pittsburgh. The Monroeville Mall. Right outside of Pittsburgh, which just as malls were taken off, which apparently it's not something in the movie, but the mall is actually much bigger than they even than emphasized in the actual movie. It's this utopia. Everything you want is there. And of course, they take over the mall. They barricade all the entrances. They lock the doors. They kill all the zombies inside. They clean it up. They have paradise, man. And of course, what happens? Other people start noticing. It's bikers, right? I mean, you think, like, it's silly, the idea of, like, well, okay, a bunch of bikers take over the mall at the end. But it works, man. It's just the fact that, you know, it's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. I mean, to sum up the R.E.M. song, that's the attitude here, man. People are buying they're stealing TVs. At one point, one of the looters goes, hey, man, get this TV. What the fuck are you going to do with that? I don't know, man. And he throws it away and just tosses it. And just destroys it for no reason. Because, like, what are you going to do with a TV, man? Who the fuck cares? One guy jerks around with a blood pressure tester. And he's got a mannequin underneath him. Why is he carrying a mannequin? Because you can. That's why. It was was the attitude of the 70s. It was, as Romero says, it was disco, rock and roll, free love, drugs. You can do whatever you want, and that's reflected on screen in Dawn of the Dead. And you might say, oh, it ages the movie because it's set there. I think it strengthens the movie that it's clearly set of that time. It's Romero remarking about that era in time, and I think it's wonderful. Even the blue, even the blue slash grayish makeup that the zombies have, I think it makes the movie better. It adds to the comic book nature of the film. That as smart as it is, at the end of the day, you are doing a silly romp. You know, there's zombies that it's silly. It's not real, but it's such a fucking wonderful movie, man. I've always said this is one of my top five movies, and again, you make up a list, and there were a couple of points when Dawn of the Dead wasn't on the top five, and I realized, like, it's got to be there, man. How could I not put it there?
Hawken, what is your number five, sir?
Well, Phil, as I always say when it comes to these lists, I like to say that these selections are in no particular order, because what can I say? I love them all. But for my number five selection, I'm going to go with Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas from 1990. You know, people always laud The Godfather as the you know, the best mob movie out there, but I like to think, you know, Goodfellas took that and really streamlined it and ran with it. Yes, it's a traditional, you know, we see someone, you know, climb their way up and then fall the way down, but it's certainly one of the best stories out there. It's a pit, you know, it's a perfect movie. And you talk about, you know, somehow not finding possible to dislike a movie. I don't know how anyone, unless you don't like violence, can dislike Goodfellas. It's just that good. It's certainly Scorsese's one of his best movies. I'm not going to say it's his best, because that is very subjective. But it's definitely up there. To me, it's a perfectly put together movie. Always enjoy to watch it, and it's just really well done stuff. And like I said, one of the best crime movies out there.
Well, I mean, it's a great movie because you realize, like, as they say, you know, it's Scorsese said this. It's a mob movie from the point of view of a foot soldier. And you think about, like, you know, do the foot soldiers live as large as the head guys do? And you realize, yeah, they do. I mean, Henry Hill is just a regular schmuck who is half Irish, half Italian. Got a little Jewish in him, if I remember correctly. Or no, was that a joke in the movie? He goes, like, you know, I'm Jewish on my mother's good side or something. But he's an outsider looking in. And it's a classic American story of a rise to power and fall from grace. It plays, it's another one, it's kind of like Shawshank Redemption. I mean, it plays on TV a lot. And actually, I will contend it's one of the few movies that you can see, and it's a hard R, and if you have to see it, for God's sake, don't watch it edited for television, but it's hard not to get sucked into it when it does play on AMC or something, because it's so fucking good. Oh, go ahead.
I was saying it's good, but you can't watch something like that on basic cable when it's edited to pieces. I mean, there's a great bit from Mr. Show where it's a skit called Pallies, and they try to do the... you know, I think they're doing the scene where they're at, you know, Joe Pesci's mom's house, and they're talking about, like, getting rid of the body in the trunk, and you're right about being the foot soldier's perspective. It's like that movie, and Donnie Brasco is another example. It's even more of a foot soldier's movie. And Godfather is the operatic, you know, movie, you know, about the top. It's a lot more than the mob. That's Coppola's always said that, and it's very clear. Goodfellas was definitely more about that, you know, the working man's, you know, mob movie. And to me, it's also a great primer on all things Scorsese, because it's got all those, you know, great Scorsese techniques. The constant use of music, you know, the moving camera, people sitting down eating.
The humor.
All great stuff like that.
He doesn't get enough credit for his humor in his films, but, like, you know, the funniest bits of the movie come from Joe Pesci, and after they kill Frank Vincent, or they haven't killed Frank Vincent yet, spoiler alert, yeah. But he's in the back of the car, and what do? Oh, we'll stop at my mom's house, and she comes in, and she's like, oh, just stay in, come on, stay in, I'll fix you something to eat, and it cuts to them eating. They've got this dead guy in the back of their car.
And that score says his mom, no less.
And she's so awesome. She's awesome in those movies. And the funniest part is she makes the painting and, like, look at my painting. And, like, you know, Pesci's character doesn't know art for anything. So he goes, yeah, there's one dog looking this way, one dog looking the other way, and there's a guy in the center. And then De Niro goes, yeah, it looks like a friend of ours, and referring to Frank Vincent. I don't know, man. That movie's so fucking fun. Remember when Henry Hill's mother, like, his wife and his mother-in-law are waiting for him to get up,
Yeah.
And he goes up in there, and he's, I don't know what he was doing. He must have been jerking with around or something. And she starts screaming, normal people don't do this! And they start.
Oh, it got a good laugh.
And then Joe Pesci's like screaming, like, she's right, Henry, you're not normal. Something's wrong with you.
Oh, there's some great, yeah, very good humor. I got to see this some time ago when they were doing a screening of it at the New Beverly, and it was great just to see it on screen. I think the other thing worth noting, I know I've heard about this about the movie, is that it also shows the life of the mob wives. And then I got Lorraine Bracco's character, who has no business being in that kind of life, because you can see all the other mob wives and how they look and talk and act, and she gets seduced by the life. It's you know what The Sopranos goes about, you know, in all its various seasons. Again, like I said, it's a classic rise and fall story, but it's so fine, you know, so well tuned. You just can't help but always check it out and always get seduced by it.
Surprisingly enough, my fifth pick is not even a North American film. It's a foreign film. And its foreign title is El Labratino Del Fano. And it's a 2006 release from Guillermo del Toro. And it's, of course, Pan's Labyrinth. I just think that this is, I love movies that are set in the real world and then it's kind of blend into fantasy. And the better or more invisible the seams are between the real aspects of the movie and the fantasy aspects, I just love that whole act of creation. And I think, even though Pan's Labyrinth is, goes to some pretty fantastic extremes, so you do have to, there still is a leap of faith in there. I just love the setting of this girl in 1944 Spain, fascist Spain during the war, and her ability to create this amazing fantasy world in what are pretty grim times. So that would be my number five pick. And I think Ivana Baquero, who played the girl Sofia, was just fantastic. Sergi Lopez as her evil stepfather was just amazing. And, of course, Doug Jones, who played the fawn and the pale man. Just some great special effects and a really beautifully shot film as well. And just a heartbreaking movie. I really have come to appreciate this, and it just goes to show that not all the best movies were made 50 years ago. There are some really great movies having been made in the last 10 years or so as well.
Oh, absolutely. Top that, Pacific Rim. That's all I have to say about that. When we see some footage, of course. I mean, God forbid, we should the guys who didn't get to go to Comic-Con should be able to have a look at it. God forbid. But anyway, well, my number five choice is my newest addition to my list. It's been slowly climbing up the list since I first saw it at the start of 2010. It was my favourite film of that year, even though it was technically a 2009 film. I found myself watching it multiple times each year since then and will continue to do so. It's become now my cinematic comfort food. It's the film I now always put on when I'm bored or I need cheering up. It is Up in the Air. For a while, I didn't know what the hell it was going to take for people to actually take notice of this one. I mean, maybe George Clooney needed to die prematurely. I don't know. Some films are ignored upon release, but eventually they find their way to people and become classics. And I feel that strongly about this film, but I just don't know if it's going to, for whatever reason, going to find its way to people that way. It's just seemed to have gotten lost in the cracks, but it's become a very special film to me because it directly addresses the basic two ways for a human being to lead their life: detached and isolated and free, or shackled, chained, but together with family, with a partner, with someone, shackled to a place you can call home. It's about a guy who lives the former lifestyle. He travels across the country laying people off during the worst economic depression in your nation's history and ours. His home is the VIP executive suites at airports. His car is a jet. And now he has so many miles with the airline he travels with that he's going to get his name on the side of a plane. His possessions are limited to the contents of a small carry-on. His actual apartment is so rare barely used, that it's not decorated, he doesn't see his family, he doesn't have anyone, and he's loving it, and then it threatens to derail when Anna Kendrick's character comes up with a way for Ryan to fire people via video conference call rather than face-to-face, a cold, detached solution that will destroy Ryan's cold, detached existence, and finally he starts to fall for a very special lady called Alex, played by Vera Farmiga, who shares his outlook on life and, ironically, is the one who will most make him change his outlook and want to be tied to another human being, all of which eventually leading to, for my money, one of the most gut-punching endings in the history of film, I think. And it's the kind of ending that would make people watching it question which side of the fence the film was on. And I think they're missing the point if they feel that way. The film isn't trying to tell the viewer that one way of living is better than the other. On the contrary, this film will reinforce whatever philosophy you go into it with. And don't listen to those stupid fucking critic quotes on the box that saying this is a first-class comedy. Ho, ho, ho. This is not. It's a drama. It's a powerful, unbelievably sharply written piece. And I adore it. You talk to me next year, it might be even higher on the list. But anytime I can't pick a film, anytime I'm bored, I will watch that one, and it never fails to entertain me. I adore that film. But anyway, Christina, what's number four?
My number four is a movie that you, Phil, actually thought was going to be my one or two. Wizard of Oz.
Shit! Wow.
High five!
All better off now. Wow, okay.
Yeah, I am a huge, huge musical buff, so I knew I had to have a musical on here, and for my money, it doesn't get any better than Wizard of Oz. I absolutely adore this movie so much. I can't even talk about it without smiling.
Or crying.
Oh, God. Judy Garland is just phenomenal in this movie. I mean, have you ever met anybody who watched that movie who didn't fall in love with her? By the time she finishes singing Over the Rainbow, you're completely in love with her. Completely in love with her. The music is just, it's so catchy and it's so fun and it drives that story. I love the characters. I love the look of that film. That moment where she opens the door and she walks into Oz and it's all Technicolor. It's such a beautiful, iconic moment, and it's such a good, warm-hearted movie. You just watch that movie, you just feel happy. I mean, even if I'm having a terrible day, I can put on that movie, and I'm immediately happy.
It makes you feel like a child.
So
again.
Sweet.
There's
yes.
Films that can really do that. There is such a childlike quality to it because she is, you know, she's a little girl. They don't say how old she is. They say she's a little girl, but she's living during the Depression, which, you know, we've had our grandparents. I don't disregard you, but it's, you know, I don't, but you know, us Americans here had grandparents during the Depression, and they would tell you, like, yeah, the old joke is, like, what was the Great Depression like? It was depressing. But it was just this it was so awful, and she transports to this other world. Like, it's just like, it has to be a dream. She says in the movie, like, I don't think we're in Kansas anymore, Toto. It's just such a magical movie, man. That is, it's not on my list, and again, it's another one that struggled for me, but if there is any movie that you would ever say, if you had to say one movie is truly perfect by the grace of God, it would have to be The Wizard of Oz. And I will, and yeah, that's even when some asshole says, oh, but you can see the cowardly lion string. Well, fuck you, that's not what I define as perfect, asshole. There's not a beat in that movie emotionally or writing of the thematic themes that doesn't ring true. It's just, and again, it is how old is that movie now? 80 years old? 1939? I mean, that is one of the, we made a joke about, we just did a record about Terminator 2. By the time this airs, it'll be a few weeks later. But this is one of the movies that you do go like, who has never seen this movie? Like, I got nieces and a nephew. They're very small. My oldest niece is 7, about to turn 8. They've seen Wizard of Oz. Like, it will be hard to imagine a generation of kids who do not grow up watching that movie. Like, there's a certain batch of films that we all grew up with and we cherished, our parents grew up with and they loved and cherished, and now the next generation, our kids, our nieces and nephews, they'll grow up loving and cherishing and so on and so forth. And this is absolutely at the top of the list.
No doubt about it. And the ending, it still gets to me. I know this is Christina's pick, and I don't mean to interrupt you. I really apologize. I'm so sorry. But this is such a perfect movie, and that ending still gets to me. It was playing on TCM, I want to say 3 weeks ago, and I had to go in the back and just, I couldn't help it. It's just, it makes me tear up still thinking about it. That ending is so beautiful, and it's so universal that there is indeed no place like home. Anyone in the world, anytime, can relate to that. That's why the movie works as well as it does.
Well, what is your number four, Jamie?
Actually, my number four pick, the site is called ThinkMcFlyThink.com after all, and I would be hard-pressed not to include Back to the Future, another one of those childhood
movies. Part two. Oh, shit.
I like part two, but no, the original Back to the Future is just, I don't even know, what is there to say about that movie that has not been said before?
Well, you picked it, sir. You better have something to say.
Well, I mean, it is the ultimate movie. It's one of those films that you go like, Chris said this about Toy Story, and I think this applies to Back to the Future. It's like, there was never not a time when it was cool to love Toy Story. Everyone, young, old, male, women, all love Toy Story. And I have no idea if that's on our list or not. It could be. I don't know. But that's, I think it applies to Back to the Future because it's just something about it. It's something for everyone. If for the older crowd, it's reflective of a time before then. You know, if we were our age in 1985 when this movie came out, like we would see it as, oh my God, can you believe it? Like this poor kid stuck in the 50s with what we have now. And if the parents watch it and they go, oh man, wasn't it so wonderful back then? And like it doesn't make fun of the fact that it's the 50s. Or no, let me rephrase that. It's not that it doesn't make fun of it. It says it with such heart and love that of the way things were in the 50s. You know, little things like watching Jackie Gleason while we eat. You know, and it's a rerun. I saw this one. What's a rerun? Oh, you'll find out. Ronald Reagan, the actor? You know, who's vice president? Jerry Lewis? I mean, everything about that movie works. Is there anything about that movie that you... I don't know. You guys say something about Back to the Future. I'm blubbering here. That's one of the movies that you hear more people say they love more than any other movie in the world is Back to the Future.
Well, the problem that I find with Back to the Future and talking about it, and I find this with a lot of movies, is that Gene Siskel said everything that needs to be said about that movie in his initial review. And I can't think of anything to actually top it. I mean, it's about...
What would you say if you think about it? Meeting your mother as a teenager, what would you feel if you saw your parents as young people? What a thrill that would be. And this film, rather than being helter-skelter action picture, which it could have been, holds on that moment. I credit the director, Bob Zemeckis, for having the sensitivity, the smarts, to make this something bigger than just a laugh-a-minute special effects picture. There's a real heart to this film. Back to the Future has all that emotion, a most clever and funny and interesting script written by Bob Zemeckis and his partner Bob Gale. And the writing here, I think, is really the star. This script couldn't have been ruined if it had been directed by the director who did Red Sonja, if it had starred the cast of Red Sonja. So I guess I've made my point. Back to the Future receives my highest recommendation of the film.
Pretty good screenplay. And like all good screenplays and all good movies, it starts out with something of universal interest, which is, in this case, what would it be like to meet your parents, as you pointed out, when they were kids? Because I think everybody grows up thinking, my parents were never young. And the fact is, the parents, this is the secret parents have from kids, they don't think they're ever old.
Right.
The wonderful, it's about the, I actually think the trilogy itself, the reason I love it, and I love all three, but they're all about something different. I love time travel, actually. I love time travel stories when they're done well. And Back to the Future trilogy, they each deal with a certain aspect of time travel and the questions that we've always asked about that concept. The first film is about the accidental misuses of time travel, about how Marty being in the wrong place at the wrong time, well, turns out he's at the right place at the right time, and seems like it's going to basically destroy the fabric of the universe and certainly destroy his existence. The second film is very much about the intentional misuses of time travel, not just Biff with the sports almanac, but also Marty and Doc deliberately, even though they should know better, go into the future to get Marty's kids out of trouble. And I think it's really because, although they never really discuss it in the film, it's really because Doc owes Marty so much. So he's going to take
that. I don't think it's that he owes him. I think it's something that goes throughout the trilogy, and Phil and I talked about this off air about really Nolan's Batman trilogy, is that there is a love between Marty and Doc that in the same way there's a love between Alfred and Bruce mm-hmm. that is
unsaid. In a way,
it's all there. You had, four great actors and very good writers and a great director in both cases. They knew that it would be more. What's the word? Rewarding, more fulfilling, more emotional, but without actually them a moment where they said "I loved you" to each other because mm-hmm. they didn't need to. Their actions, their looks, you know, with Doc and Brent, it's a love of a friendship. Because you never find out how these guys became friends. It is weird. It's like Marty's 17, a 17-year-old teenager in the mid-80s, and Doc is, I guess, in his mid-late 50s, I guess. They never really say. Maybe early 60s, but I don't think it's that far off. How the fuck did these two guys meet? It's like, it doesn't matter. They're friends. And throughout the trilogy, but you see it in the first movie in particular, at the end of the movie when he thinks Doc's been shot, and he starts weeping, and then like Doc starts blinking, and the way the music goes, the Alan Silvestri score, the diddle diddle, and he gets up, and the way this the little whistling music in the background, and he pulls out the note that he thought he tore up, and he's like, mm. I thought you tore it up, you know, and he's just like, what about all that talk about changing the future and you know the space time continuum? And he says, what the hell? I just thought, what the hell? And then like at the end when he pulls him up to his car and. He just says, where are you going? And, you know, remember they shake each other's hands, and he goes, you take care. And he just kind of looks at him and says, you too. And, like, that said it more about their relationship than anything else, was that little delivery. The way Doc looks at him says, you too.
Okay, so.
Are we done blubbering about that movie?
I believe we are, sir. Captain Falcon, okay, what is your number four?
Well, Phil, my number four is certainly different from the other selections. My number four is a, you know, somewhat obscure, and perhaps maybe it is and it isn't. It's a movie called Repo Man. Alex Fox's first movie from 1984. When I discovered this movie around my 21st birthday, this movie was I wouldn't necessarily call it a revelation, but it certainly changed and explained my outlook and attitude on life. It's an odd movie, I'll give it that, but it's just so, I just enjoy that, just really enjoy what it is. Just the attitude, and also the, you know, and just the absurdity of that attitude on top of that. That's, well, of that kind of, you know, trying to be, you know, against society punk attitude and the problems associated with it and the ridiculousness of it and just the, you know, I don't even know what we're supposed to be doing, you know, anymore kind of attitude. And on top of that, the surrealness of the movie, everything with its generic products, the unknown object in the trunk, a very unglamorous look of Los Angeles, and probably the best performance we would ever get out of Emilio Estevez.
Or Harry Dean Stanton.
Now, Harry Dean Stanton's always been very good. He's always done very good work.
Yeah, but I think this
is great in this.
Yeah, I think this is best, though. I mean, he's wonderful. I get a bunch
in the odd philosophical discussions that just come from this movie that really has no story, and the ending just goes off, you know, into another place, and... It's a ride, I'll give it that, and I always enjoyed it, again, for that kind of not-so-serious attitude that it has.
I mean, but, there's a lot of weird movies, like, in terms of, like, just its uniqueness and offness that pay a lot of tribute to Repo Man that we don't even realize. I mean, one could argue that I could, you know, like, you know Kevin Smith, that we wouldn't see him, maybe even Quentin Tarantino, without something as off, something as odd as Repo Man. And I don't say that as, that's a compliment to how unique the movie is, how weird it is.
And it is a shame that, I mean, Alex Cox, I mean, he had that, he had Sid and Nancy, and I know he had a movie called Walker, but that guy's never really been able to get his career off the ground. I don't know if that's self-intentional or...
I think it might be because of him, but, like, I don't know.
Probably,
that.
But yeah. it is a shame, because it was, you had a movie like that, and you think, man, I wonder what this guy's going to do next, and we never really got that.
Yeah, he did Sid and Nancy, which is a really good movie, and then he just kind of, you know, at one point he was going to be the guy to do Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas for a while. And if you have the criterion of that DVD, you know, like, they don't have nice things to say about Alex, about him. Let's just put it like that. Go buy the damn DVD. You'll find it. You'll hear the stories. But, I mean, yeah, come on. The movie has the philosophical discussions about John Wayne being a fag. A discussion,
and that's a great scene, by the way.
Yeah, a discussion that you would never hear now or in 1984 any other movie. Like, talk about, like, just come on, man.
just the philosophy of life, you know, coming out of a basically a very sleazy, you know, repossession operation where they're very serious about their jobs. Very. I mean, I know the movie's immensely quotable, and it's also well known for its clean version that was done by Cox himself, where it has such ridiculous replacement, you know, curse words, and it's filmed like that.
Really?
So it's, oh, yeah.
I did not know this.
There's a very famous, you know, Flip You Melon Farmer, and it's filmed that way. It's not like they have the overdubbed voice that doesn't match the actor, you know, put in those words. No, they went out of their way to make a clean version of the movie. That's why the curse words are absolutely ridiculous. What they replace them with are ridiculous, are very, very silly. And I also like to mention the great work by the guy who played Bob in Batman. He's known as Miller in this movie. He's the Repo Man mechanic.
Tracy Walter.
That's right. He's the philosophical core of the movie about his views on why you should never drive and the theory behind plate of shrimp and the fact that you'll always find a pine tree air freshener in every car. I mean, it's like that movie and Buckaroo Banzai can sum up the entire, you know, that new wave line of thinking for the 80s.
Well, I mean, also, it's like, remember the scene where, like, the guy who takes his girlfriend gets shot in the convenience store? He's like, oh, man, I'm so sorry. And his head is he's bleeding to death in the head. And remember what he says? I blame society. He just gets up and leaves him.
It's like, that's bullshit. You're a white suburban punk, just like me. And he dies. That's, again, why I like the attitude so much. It's doing both the basically trying to have that F you to society, but also realizing, you know, what nonsense it is. You know, and are just, you know, the place where we are in life and all that. I mean, I'm not going to lie. Some people may not like this movie. I could it be considered an acquired taste?
Kind
perhaps.
Of.
I think you got to be in the mindset. But I think the movie's legitimately funny at points.
Okay, so we are going to go back a little bit further in time now. This is a movie from 1962. And it's amazing that some properties come along for when whatever field, be a musician, a writer, an actor. And this particular project had probably for two people the single most notable contribution that they ever did in their career. And I'm talking about To Kill a Mockingbird, the book that was written by Harper Lee, and the role of Atticus Finch that Gregory Peck seemed to born to play. And, of course, everybody hopefully has seen this movie. It's just a fantastic movie. Something that I've come to really appreciate the older I get. It may be set in the Depression era South, but it's really a snapshot of a time. Because the movie was made in the 60s, it's really a snapshot of a society moving from one era to another. It's just I just really can't say much about it. It's maybe a black and white movie, but it takes nothing away. And actually it probably adds to the atmosphere of this movie, but it's just such a powerful story. And Gregory Peck is just amazing in it. And if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend that you check it out and read the book as well.
It's funny you mention that one, actually, because my film is also a, if you want to label it, courtroom drama, also about an insane case and innocently accused, but a much more obscure film. Luckily, two of the people sitting here have seen it, thanks to that wonderful little tool we use, the Moan of the Week. My fourth favourite film is Indictment, the McMartin Trial. We've talked about this one before. I will reiterate again here the plot for you, since so little of you have actually seen it. Indictment is actually a HBO made-for-TV movie from 1995. Indictment is also, for my money, the quickest 130 minutes you will ever spend sitting down. It is a furiously paced courtroom drama based on the true story of the most infamous child abuse case in US legal history, the case of the McMartin Preschool, who whose teachers and owners were accused of the sexual molestation of hundreds of children over the course of several years, a case that starts with one accusation of sexual abuse from one less than credible witness, and then spirals once the children start getting put on the stand into stories of satanic rituals and plane trips to Palm Springs. Obviously, a case which never should have gone to trial, so flimsy was the evidence, and yet so concerned was the public on the issue, so huge and skewered was the media coverage and the portrayal of the McMartins, and so deluded were the prosecution that it did go to trial, only to end several years later, millions of dollars spent, and without a single conviction. It's a story of mass hysteria and mass delusion. It's a story with twists so wild that you would not believe them in a fictional story, and is a credible story about a country gone insane. And the film is very special to me for two reasons. James and Woods. No, that's not quite true. But the first reason is that the film did start my love of James Woods, my favourite actor, who, as defence attorney Danny Davis in the film, is the one who, in almost every scene, is propelling the film forward with his boundless energy, his inability to phone in a single line, and his daring performance in playing someone who is not necessarily a good person and is completely honest about it. But the second reason, more importantly, this is the first film where I actually remember feeling smart and proud of myself after I'd seen it, because this was the first film I remember seeing that didn't have a single fantasy-type element to it. It was a real story about real people intelligently dealing with an adult and horrific subject matter, and yet I was completely hooked, and I discovered that I had an appetite for other kinds of films. Not least, I wanted to see other films made by Indictment's director, Mick Jackson, which led me to a little film called Threads. And I don't think I need to say any more about that tonight, but that film will always be very, very special to me. Christina, what is number three?
I actually just did a last-second swap of my number three and my number two, because it's that close in my head with these two films, but my number three now is Beauty and the Beast. I absolutely adore this movie top to bottom. The animation is beautiful. That ballroom sequence is just, it's a technical masterpiece to me. I think it's beautiful. The music is great. The characters are all wonderful, funny, colorful characters who I love. Even that douchebag Gaston. I love the message of the film. I love their love story. It's such a cute, sweet, beautiful movie. I just love that movie so much. It's wonderful. And that IMAX re-release that came out a few years ago is just phenomenal. It looked so good. Even though there's still some dodgy animation in the backgrounds where some people's faces are kind of weird looking, but even still, I can overlook small flaws because this movie is just, it's so good. I love Beauty and the Beast.
Well, Jamie, what is number three?
Number three, how should I put this, man? Ever since I was a little kid, I wanted to be Indiana Jones, and that kind of says it right there, man. It's Raiders of the Lost Ark, man. I would say the greatest action-adventure movie ever made. Where to go into it, I don't need to explain the plot. We all know Indiana Jones. I guess it comes down to, like, what makes that character so special? What makes that movie? It's not that it's nonstop action. It's just, it's, I think, what has always been appealing about that character, Indiana Jones, is that he was the first action hero I can think of who was mortal. And it's funny to think about James Bond, who was the influence. Of course, everyone knows the story about how Spielberg wanted to do a Bond movie and Cubby Broccoli would never let him. Understandably. And Spielberg and Lucas came up with Indiana Jones as their answer to Bond because they can never do the real McCoy. And in many ways, they topped it. Bond is someone who you sort of look up to. Like, he's this iconic hero. He has all the cool gadgets. You look at the Connery Bond films and even Lazenby and Roger Moore. Like, I can't think of a moment where Connery, any of those guys bled. And there's something about that. Something you can relate to when you see the hero actually bleeds. He draws blood. He gets hurt during a fight. Like, that's what's so wonderful about Raiders of the Lost Ark is there's so many moments where Indy almost gets his... He gets his ass kicked. He's about a hair away from death, and he somehow avoids it. And we see the after effects. We see that he's bruised up. He has that wonderful line that sums it up perfectly. It's not the years, honey. It's the mileage. And, of course, you realize, like, at that point, Indy's probably in his mid-late 30s. So he's been doing that shit for years, hunting adventures. But, you know, everything... I just... It's just such a great adventure movie, man. It still holds up to this day. What do you guys think, man? Raiders.
Oh, no, man. That is the one movie where literally what can we say at this point that's not been said?
You see the influence of all the action heroes nowadays. And, like, you know, people say Die Hard's the great action movie, and it's up there. But one thing that has in common is that McTiernan and those guys were smart to be like, we have to make McClane a human being. We have to see him get hurt. Like the scene where he has to run over glass, and the whole audience goes, ugh! And like we see him like crawling into the bathroom and his blood all over his feet. And that's something you can relate to. That John McClane was a real guy. Indiana Jones was a real guy. Like, yes, he is this, it's the 1930s. He is a college professor. It's a profession that people look up to. It's highly regarded. He has the whole Superman Clark Kent thing going for him, which I'm assuming was intentional. You know, it's university. I don't even know if they ever say what university he teaches at. They might. Someone will have to fill me in on that. You know, he's very conservative dressed, and he's got glasses. He's clean shaven. He's got his hair done back. But it's like Superman. Like, Superman is born the way he really is he's this guy in this red and blue suit flying around. Clark Kent's the disguise. That's the disguise of Henry Jones Jr. Indiana Jones is this guy who wears this dirtied up clothes. He sleeps in it all the time. He's rugged. He's got he's got the stubble on his face. He gets in adventures. That's who he really is at heart, man.
He's got Pa Kent and Marcus in a way.
That's right. Oh, that's absolutely right. Yeah, at least in the first one.
Don't bring that up.
I love Last Crusade. I love what they turned Marcus into in the third movie. I don't know if you did. Apparently,
like,
by the way, you say
I fucked up Marcus. I don't understand why. No, I didn't hate it. I understand why.
But that's actually the biggest laugh I think in all four movies is like him building up Marcus as.
It's perfectly obvious where the pages are. He's given them to Marcus Brody.
Marcus, you didn't drag poor Marcus along, did you? He's not up to the challenge.
He sticks out like a sore thumb. We'll find him.
The hell you will. He's got a 2-day head start on you, which is more than he needs. Brody's got friends in every town and village from here to the Sudan. He speaks a dozen languages, knows every local custom. He'll blend in, disappear. You'll never see him again. With any luck, he's got the grail already.
Does anyone here speak English?
Hawken, what's your number three?
Well, my number three, Phil, is definitely another Stone Cold classic, but again, for a little bit of a different reason. Also from the 80s. But, you know, even then, it's still pointing to this day, even though it does look dated, I'm not going to lie. It's 1987's RoboCop. And what can you say about this movie that already hasn't been said? You know, great satire, great action. Sure, it's, you know, basically making, you know, taking the Terminator idea and now making him a good guy before T2 came out. But now you have this fantastic movie that, I mean, you know, on paper, that would look like a very cheap knockoff, but so well put together, and really, you know, just, again, speaks to a lot of that, you know, the corporate mindset of what was going on at the time and still to this day, and just how it was really lightning in a bottle, that movie. And again, another immensely quotable, to this day, type of movie.
It's also how emotional it is. You realize, like, for a movie like that, like, you feel bad for the guy. You realize, like, he was a human being once. Like, he goes to his old home, it's empty, mm-hmm. and, like, his own system, you wonder, like, what's happening, and you realize, like, his own computer system is being corrupted by, not a virus, it's his memories. Like, that was so wonderful that, you know, something as silly as TJ Laser, yet it comes around. And, yeah, I mean, this is, the reason that movie works so well, I think it's been said before, but it's like, Verhoeven, man. That's the only, I mean, yeah. Didn't you had Peter Weller. You actually got to see a screening, and didn't he say, like, that's the reason it worked? Like, came right out of his mouth.
Right. Basically, yeah. I mean, I'm not going to quote him specifically. I have to say, even, like, little things that were brought to my attention, you know, by, you know, my best friend, you know, pointing me out that the RoboCop theme is, you know, from The Bride of Frankenstein, I believe. And also, again, it's, you know, as Jamie had once said, you know, some, you know, when we were talking about RoboCop 2, you know, RoboCop is a, you know, it's a Jesus parable, if not one of the best Jesus parables out there, you know, about the story of Murphy and old Detroit and, you know, him coming back as now RoboCop. So it takes one of those basic stories, and it is a basic story, but it's infused with such intelligence, and it's so smart about its violence. It's just it really is great work. Again, it's one of those immensely watchable movies.
Okay, my number three. This is a movie that is only 1 year younger than me, and it came out in 1959. And again, it's one of those movies that kind of parallels, depending on your belief system, some true events from the past, but it follows that storyline and parallels it, and that is 1959's Charlton Heston, Ben-Hur. But it's still one of the most sprawling, amazing, epic films of all time, regardless of your belief system or not, and there's just some amazing, and there's an amazing cast in it, beyond Charlton Heston, Stephen Boyd, and you can go on and on, Peter Ustinov. It's just an amazing movie, very touching, and yeah, the crowd scenes, the chariot scenes, it still stands up as one of the all-time classic action scenes of cinema. It's just a fantastic, fantastic movie.
I will admit it's the kind of film, and we say this a lot, but it literally is the kind of film you couldn't make today. Not for the reasons that you might think, not for reasons of scope or scale or budget, but the story construction is odd and unique, to say the least. You have a story about an antagonism, which really is a story about two brothers, and the fact that the one brother dies at the 3-hour mark, and then the movie goes on for another 40 minutes dealing with that. His mother and his sister, who he needs to cure of leprosy, although I'm not sure if he figures out how he's going to do that, but it happens by divine right because it is a tale of the Christ when it all comes down to it. You couldn't make that today. People would walk out. If they can't handle 12 endings of Return of the King that goes on for 10 minutes, longer than they think it should, they can't handle 40 minutes after the chariot race is over.
Yeah. But, yeah, I don't know, just following his whole journey, like on the slave ships, and there's one shot of where their ship has been scuttled, and you know, the prisoners are all chained to their stations, and they're trying to get free, and there's one shot of a guy that's running away from him, and his arm's missing, like from about halfway down his between his wrist and his hand, and you know, he's just running. I'll never forget that shot. It made an impression on me as a kid, and every time I see it, I still go, wow, that's that's pretty intense for that time period. But I don't know, it's just, I love stories that, as I said with my other picks, parallel or touch on real life events, but then weave off into a different direction, which is what this does. And I just thought it was really well done.
My number three is Big. Now, there's a category of film, it's not even a genre really, but it's one that's special to my heart, and that's the child wish fulfillment genre. And it can apply to many different types of films, but I reckon that somewhere on everybody's top favourite films is one that they grew up with, involving a young character that is in some way either physically or metaphorically transported from their ordinary life into the one that they want. And obviously, if one works for you, it's because it's tapping into something that you wish you could do or be, or a place you could go to. And even today, I want to work for that toy company and do Tom Hanks' job in Big, even though I don't think that job actually even exists. But there is one important element that separates Big from all those other types of film, I think. The usual way that the story goes is that the kid will get their wish fulfilled, they'll have everything that they thought they could ever want, and then life gets complicated in some way, or they run into some criminals if it's a bad film, and they start having problems, and they have to let their fantasy life go at the end because, of course, there's no place like home. Big does it differently. Josh Baskin becomes an adult and immediately wants to take it back. He has to leave home and live in fucking Hell's Kitchen in New York from Daredevil. That's what it looks like. He has to get a job. It's a horrible life. It's reality. But then he gets a dream job where he will be set for life, the job he was born to do. He has a dream apartment. He falls in love. He actually becomes an adult. Credibly, he's got it made. And at the end of the film, he's not going back to his ordinary life because he has to. He's going because he had to make an agonizingly difficult decision, one that I'm not sure all of us could have made. He has to choose between a life he's made for himself and the one waiting for him back home, and all the pros and cons that came with it before. But now, having lost his sense of innocence, knowing what the real world is like, and having to crawl back to adulthood the slow way, and it's a poignant ending. He's going back to being a child, but he has lost his childhood in a lot of ways and can't reclaim it. It's deep, if you really think about it that way. Jamie, of course, was the one who told me about some mythical alternate ending which nobody's ever seen, where apparently Elizabeth Perkins' character herself uses the Zoltar machine to become young and stay with Josh. And thank Christ, if it's real, that they didn't use that, because it would completely undermine the hard choice that he had to make. It's one of those have your cake and eat it too endings that we'd get today if they remade it. And that might actually happen one day, you never know. Another miracle about Big as a story is that, if you really think about it, it deals with some pretty dark stuff that is not at all easy to make light of, and yet somehow pulls it off with an amazing...
Well, the fact that, like, he's kidnapped. Like, or at least the parents think he's kidnapped.
It's amazing. I mean, the issue, Josh has to maintain a facade to his mother that his younger self has been kidnapped and God knows what's happening to him. And there is no greater example of how this film... probably could not have been made today than the one where, you know the one I'm thinking of, Josh rings his mother at work, yep, while pretending to be the kidnapper with John Lovitz in the background listening in, and he's singing Memories, and she's breaking down, crying.
And it plays as a laugh, and yet you think about it, Phil, and you go, that is fucked up.
It's not...
That could have completely been a horror movie.
It totally could. You don't... I mean, a lot of credit has to go to Mercedes Rule. It's a small part, but she is absolutely crucial to making the thing work as the parent.
And Penny Marshall's direction.
But, I mean, if you think about the parent, what if someone like Mel Gibson's character in Ransom was the parent? I mean, that would have been a different movie. In fact, I put together a little clip showing you exactly how different it would be. Let's have a look.
Hi, this is Matt. Hello, I live right over by the river. You ever seen Brooklyn by Dawn?
No! Shit, Jack! Any demands, but come on. Now you just agree. You didn't know he's in charge. Your only priority is getting your boy back. Get your boy back. You follow me? Now, you've got to give us some time, Mr. Mullen. You have to speak to your son, ask for some sign that he's alive. Any information you can get. Then tell me he has an allergy. He has some medical condition. You want to know what kind of weather is he in? Is he indoors? Is he outdoors? Are we set?
Go!
Get your boy back.
Hello?
Hello. How are you?
I just wanted you to know that, Josh is alright and he's okay and everything.
Hey, you think I'm a fucking idiot?
Yeah.
I want to get this over with.
Wow, thanks.
So how do I get my son back?
Ask me something that only he would know. Then I'll ask him for you, and that way you'll know that he's okay.
No, I know he's dead.
Well, I didn't do anything to him. I think he's a terrific kid.
My son is dead. Go to hell!
What did you do? Tom, what did you do?
Oh, God. Please, God. Please, God. Please, God.
Mm-hmm. Madam.
Hi, this is Matt.
For the capture of...
What?
Look, you're gonna see him again really soon. I promise.
No, put him back on. I want to talk to him.
Oh, he can't come to the phone right now.
Is it dark where you're calling from? You got the shades drawn? Kind of like a cellar, right? Like a cave? Well, you better get used to that. You better get used to crawling in the dark for the rest of your days, because I am going to get the best group of manhunters in this country, and I am going to dedicate my life to tracking you down.
All right.
I don't get my son back, and I mean real soon. You better kill yourself, because when I catch up with you, I'm going to take my goddamn time.
By the time we're finished, you're going to wish you weren't born.
I'll have your head on a fucking pike. You understand me?
I got it.
Fuck you and your 2 million. Don't you understand English, you useless piece of shit?
Memories, like the corner of my mind. Misty water called her ma'am.
I want to talk!
You kill him! You kill yourself, you motherfucker! Give me back my son! We'll talk about this later.
It's a wonderful, amazing film, and it never takes the easy way out. It never does a cheap joke. It answers that question that so many children have asked, and it does so with maturity. And it's Tom Hanks' best performance. Period. Period. The only regret about Big, I think, is that unlike every other successful film of the 80s and the 90s, they never made an animated series out of it. I mean, the premise would be so simple.
Oh, yeah.
Think about it. Zoltar is not just a fortune-telling machine that grants real wishes. Zoltar is actually an evil sorcerer trapped by a spell to live as an arcade machine. But then he gets freed by Josh Baskin and he tries to take over the world. And now Josh has to set things right in the show. But, you know, he has in the show the power to transform at will between his young self and his adult self, and he lives a double life akin to a superhero. He still lives with his mom and he goes to school, or tries to, but he's also got to work at Macmillan Toys and deal with Paul, the gym executive.
That's right. I don't get it.
Making a beg. And then, of course, he's in league with Zoltar in the show. Why didn't they make this? If Free fucking Willy can get an animated series, surely.
With a cyborg villain.
Okay. Christina, what's your number two?
My number two is The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King. Love this movie. And if you strip away all of the computers and all the CG and all the great battle scenes and everything, at the end of the day, this movie is about friendship, sacrifice, and above all else, this is a movie about love. And please refrain from making the homoerotic Sam and Frodo jokes, because we've heard a million of them. But that relationship between the two of them is so pure and so good-hearted. I love Sam. He's such a good, pure character. Because in any relationship, whether it's a friendship, whether it's a romance, anything, there's always a little bit of selfishness there. You're spending time with this person because you want something from them. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's a fact. You want company, or you want shelter, or you want money, or you want sex, or something. There's always something there that you want from that person. And Sam wants nothing from Frodo. All he wants is for Frodo to be okay. That's it. And you would be very hard-pressed to find a moment more moving, and I'm probably going to cry right now just talking about it. But that moment where Sam picks Frodo up and literally puts the burden of the ring on his back and carries him up the side of Mount Doom. I mean, every time I see that movie, I know it's coming. I know it's coming, and I still lose it crying every single time. Or that moment where Aragorn is standing there on the battlefield right before he charges off to what looks to be certain death. And he turns back to his friends, and he just says two words, for Frodo. And he takes off running with two little hobbits as his backup, which is just...
Yeah, that shot where, like, everyone outruns him is so just, like, doesn't... Like, it wasn't meant as a laugh. It was meant to show how behind they all are. It's like they're running, and, like, everyone outruns them, but, like, they're still staring, like, right behind Aragorn.
And that movie is just filled with so many payoffs, not just for the first two movies, but payoffs for things that we're discovering in this movie, like what happens with Faramir, that great moment where Eowyn whips off her helmet and she goes, I am no man, and then she kills, what's his face, the Witch King, I think he's called?
Yeah.
And that moment just brings the house down every single time. Or that moment where Gandalf and, I think it's Pippin? It's Pippin, because I always get Merry and Pippin confused. Gandalf and Pippin are in Minas Tirith, and they're sitting by the doors, and the enemy troops are beating on the doors and are about to break in. And Pippin is scared to death, and he's asking Gandalf, what's it like to die? And Gandalf says, it's not bad, it's peaceful, and it's good, and it's such a beautiful moment where he comforts him. And yes, the CGI is great. Yes, the Battle of Pelennor Fields is one of the best battle sequences ever put on film. And yes, the movie has 50 million endings that some people bitched about, but I really don't have a problem with. That movie is wholly, wholly satisfying to me. And yes, the moment where Aragorn says you bow to no one, and everybody bows, and oh my god, the little hobbits are just standing there.
Yeah, everyone with everyone.
Somebody else.
I don't buy the 20 endings argument, by the way. I think it's bullshit, but that's just me. My number two pick, I'm big, Christina just picked Lord of the Rings Return of the King, which is a wonderful choice, by the way, not to reiterate. But, I have my own sword and sorcery epic that I prefer, as much as I love Peter Jackson's trilogy, and as much as I don't give two shits about his Hobbit trilogy. My pick is actually John Borman's Excalibur. I love the movie. I mean, like, I was already into the King Arthur mythology at that time around 15 years ago, reading stuff like, you know, Once and Future King and, you know, Morte d'Arthur, which is and all that stuff. The Sword in the Stone, that wonderful, you know, Disney animated movie. This got me, I mean, and it's funny because Phil and I both have a sheer hatred for First Knight. Like, the movie that decides to make Sean Connery King Arthur and fucks it up every way possible. But I don't know, I mean, I thought it's got the most human. It's funny, like, you could see Nigel Terry's King Arthur. You could see this guy really existed. And I still think he is the best performance, like, on screen, like, flesh and blood. Like, you feel like this guy was a real king, and he could really, as I say in the movie, it's like, well, you know, a great king can look into the hearts of men. And, like, you see this guy empathize with his opponents, and he cares, man. He's a great leader. And you see him go from being this nebbish teenager who accidentally pulls the sword from the stone only because his brother's sword got stolen, to being the war-weary, tired old man who has to come out for one last job, which is a terrible cliche, in order to restore the land and, you know, bring peace back to England. It's a wonderful movie. It also has the best of Merlin performance by the late, great Nacho Williamson, who passed away about 3 or 4 months ago. That's on his tombstone, man. I mean, that's a Merlin that's a weird performance, dude, but something about it is just so right with that movie. It's just such a great, man, you feel like you're transported to that time. Everything about it feels real, and yes, you look at it now, and some people say, oh, well, they clearly had no money. Some people would argue that it's campy in the third act once they start going into the Grail search. I think it's terrifying once you see all those poor knights looking around for this really silly this silly search for something that might not even exist, and yet Percival somehow overcomes it all, gets the Grail, but like all the images of like knights hanging up their corpses, it's, oh my god, man. You guys laugh at me for my pick, but I love
it. No! Say, you introduced me to it. I waited for the Blu-ray because we knew the DVD quality is shit, so I waited for the Blu-ray, and I am forever in your debt. I adored the movie. I do think it's a bit long and baggy, but that's part of its charm. I mean, it doesn't hold anything back. I adore it. I presume this means that your first pick is George Romero's Knight Riders.
No.
For my number two pick, and I admit this always fluctuates with my number one pick, again, I'm going with another iconic film of the 80s. Hey, it just happens to be that decade. I'm not going to say I haven't seen stuff from decades before then. But this movie lends a lot of influence to the movies of today in a lot of ways. And that, of course, is 1982's Blade Runner. Now, I'm referring to the movie itself, not necessarily any one specific cut. That's another discussion. But the fact that there's so many cuts lends to the notoriety of this movie. I mean, the making of this movie is about as interesting, if not even more interesting, than the movie itself. Now, I'm not going to lie. If you're not into design and production, you know, I guess you know, that aspect of the movie, you're not going to be very interested. As Harrison Ford said about this movie, I play a detective who doesn't do very much detecting. And that's true. This movie is the best example I could think of where style does trump over substance, but it's so beautifully done, and it's not something we've ever seen before. And it's just, anytime anyone does a science fiction movie about an urban landscape, there's always the influence of Blade Runner. I know, you know, when Batman Begins was being filmed, it was a movie that Christopher Nolan screened to everybody before they were going to go create Batman Begins. It's a movie that has just a huge amount of influence. And again, I'm not going to lie, is the story all that fascinating? It can be, but, you know, it, it, you know, it can, you know, it kind of reminds me of something about, like, say, V for Vendetta, where if you hadn't come across those concepts for the first time, and if you're of a certain age, you're blown away by it. But at the same time, you don't want to be too overly reliant, because the ideas themselves may not necessarily be that deep. And, you know, as time goes on, of course, it's not just about the ideas of, you know, what's meant to be human and the, you know, the manufacture of memories and dreams. I think, if anything, Dark City does a great job with that also. But, you know, this movie was really the first one to do it, and to take an idea that was, you know, I've never read the Philip K. Dick story, which has nothing really to do with the movie. It's something that they were able to take from that story and distill it into this. And it really just amazingly well done, despite its production troubles and all that.
Lou, what is your number two?
Okay, well, this is kind of my cheater pick, because it's not one movie, it's three, and that probably gives it away. But for three Christmases in a row, starting in 2001 and going all the way through 2003, and I can qualify this pick in a way because I saw all three movies at one screening, so to me it was one long movie, and that, of course, is the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And I heard Christina's picked Return of the King. I just think all three of these movies together just represent something that I don't really think that we're ever going to see again in cinema. And it really is one long story, and it shows that how difficult it is to marry the epic story against the individual story. And I think that this trilogy, on that level alone, just deserves special mention, because we've seen it with two movies this summer that tried to do that, Prometheus and The Dark Knight Rises, where they tried to marry big ideas against character moments, and it didn't work. So it just shows you how difficult it is to do that. And admittedly, Peter Jackson had a great source to run his series against, but to do that cinematically, it's quite a feat. And I can't break these up into one movie. To me, three movies. To me, they're just one long movie. So that would be my number two pick.
My number two is, we're getting into the category of films now where we cannot possibly say anything more that hasn't already been said about them, but of all the films I've talked about, even more than my number one pick, Aliens is the film that I can watch anytime, anywhere, and never get bored. It is a miracle of a film. James Cameron created one of the true self-contained sequels, and I know because it was years of watching Aliens before I got around to seeing the first film, and yet that sequel taught me everything I needed to know about this world and this concept. In fact, what surprised me the most upon seeing the first film was how different the character of Ripley is between those two. I mean, Cameron did something which I don't think has ever been done with another sequel, in that he really rebuilt the character from the ground up, not feeling trapped by anything in the first film, feeling the need to write her in a certain way, like the no-nonsense, Jobsworth, cold bitch that she was in the first film, and there was a point behind that, but she was a different character. He took the tiniest bit of information he could glean from the first film, that Ripley obviously had a family back home, a daughter, and used that as a springboard for everything that would drive the character in this movie. Someone who is credibly traumatized by an event, a woman who isn't even safe in her sleep, a woman who's had her only reason for coming home, her daughter, ripped away from her. Her daughter died of old age, no less. How the hell does that fuck up your head as a mother? And, you know, it's a woman who finds everything that she needs again by going back to the source of all her tragedy. She finds a child. She becomes a mother again. And the defining moment of the whole film for me is not one that most people talk about. It's the moment in the freight elevator as Ripley is traveling down alone into the Queen's lair to rescue Newt. She's checked her ammo count on her guns, she's strapping the pulse rifle and the flamethrower together to make a super gun, she throws it around her, and then she just closes her eyes and breathes, covered in sweat, waiting for the doors to open. And the music is as big and pulse-pounding as it's ever gotten. It's a moment earned by the previous 2 hours. I mean, I would argue that there is not a single character in all of film whose side the audience is on more. than Ripley in Aliens. She found a child again. She formed a wonderful relationship under the most traumatic of circumstances. She has a reason to live. And these fucking creatures are going to take it away from her again to give her even more nightmares she'll have to live with. No more. It ends now. Nobody else in the universe can beat these things except her. Nobody else has the drive. And of course, when she comes face to face with her enemy, it's another mother. Which is an idea of pure genius that I doubt anyone else could have come up with. I know Harlan Ellison wrote The Terminator before Cameron did, but Ellison did not come up with the Alien Queen. And the Queen remains my favourite movie creature. To this day, despite all of the exhaustive making-of material you could find on the DVDs and the Blu-rays, I cannot fathom how they made this thing. It's not a puppet. When that thing first pulls its head out of its crown and reveals itself with all the acid dripping down its face and it roars at Ripley, that thing is real. That thing terrifies me to this day. And it has one of the greatest ensembles of characters ever. And they're not really as broad as you think. There's a lot of quite restrained performances there. Paul Reiser as Berg, he's actually not really that slimy. He's quite normal. He's quite reasonable until the end. Michael Biehn, just by being himself, is so fucking cool. You would follow him if you were in that situation. Jeanette Goldstein as Vasquez is naturally powerful and capable and kick-ass without showing off. Bill Paxton gives the performance of his career as a character who goes actually on the most complex character journey in the film, second to Ripley. He's a guy who is so cocky and he has such faith in all the Marines' high-tech equipment. He's a guy who isn't scared at all because victory is certain. And then, the moment that it isn't, he just falls to pieces and he gets his balls back right at the end. It has the best pace of any film I've ever seen. Where you literally cannot see where time has gone. It never fails. I'm watching it. By the time the first firefight's over and half the Marines are dead, I mean, you think you're only like, 40, 45 minutes in. You're actually 70 minutes in. By the time the aliens charge the compound by coming from the ceiling and they take out Hudson, you think, maybe 90 minutes in. You're actually a full 2 hours in. And then the double climax comes, which ensures that the film does not take a breather from that point. And then the final amazing thing about Aliens is the immersion it creates. LV-426 is a completely realised world the way that Cameron shoots it. And you feel like you're there. Very few films can really do that. Blade Runner is a wonderfully realised world, but I don't feel like I'm there, personally. I'd like to be. Looks cool. But I'm not there. With Aliens, you are there. And it's the reason why I know critics at the time complained that they felt genuinely uncomfortable watching it. That's why. You should get a reaction like that. It's amazing. We don't need 3D, and we don't need tricks, and we don't need movable seats that react to the fucking screen like a simulator, right? We don't need tricks like that. We just need good filmmaking. And of course, most of all, the film cost $18 million. Even in 1986, that is a fucking miracle. It's Aliens, it fucking rocks. Christina, you are right. Your opinion is right. So, what is the best film ever made?
Phil, you already know what this is. You already know.
I'm not quite sure I do, actually. Because I thought it was going to be Wizard of Oz, so I'm sorry, I'm wrong. Oh, no, wait, shit, I do, of course I do. What am I talking about? Sorry, you've already... I know, it's The Lion King, sorry.
Of course it's The Lion King, are you kidding me?
Idiot, sorry.
My love of all things Disney has been well documented on this podcast. I love musicals, I love animation, and I love watching a movie that can move me. And The Lion King was the first movie I ever saw that moved me to tears in the theater. I've told my Lion King story a million times. Here goes a million and one. I saw Lion King opening weekend. We got to the theater late. So we had to sit in the very, very front, right in the middle. So I'm sitting there, little kid sitting right there in the middle at the very front row. And then that sunrise comes on screen. And that music pours out of the speakers. And I was just blown away. completely blown away. By the time Simba got lifted up into the air, I had tears falling down my face, and I had no idea why. I was just so moved by what I was seeing. And even though I'd seen a ton of Disney movies up to that point, most of the Disney movies that I'd seen were cutesy and happy and fun and all of that. So when Mufasa gets killed in The Lion King, I was just devastated. I was so hurt. I was literally like, I was grabbing onto my dad's arm. I had my head in his arm and I was just sobbing. I couldn't believe that they actually killed him. I was just so heartbroken. And I love the music. It's a beautiful film. I love the story. There's nothing about that movie that I dislike. To me, it's a perfect film. It's absolutely perfect. There's nothing that's going to be able to top The Lion King for me. And every generation, I think, has had that movie where they just get their heart broken by it. I mean, the generation before me had Bambi, and people my age had Mufasa dying, and now little kids are getting destroyed by Pixar. So I love Disney.
Yeah.
Oh God, Up. Oh God, don't even get me started on that.
Sorry.
But I've always loved Disney, and nothing will be able to top The Lion King to me. That movie has my heart. I love The Lion King.
So Jamie, what is your number one?
Actually, Ed Hawken mentioned it earlier, not in his pick, but in his comparison. But it comes on every Christmas on AMC. I've mentioned AMC a couple of times now, but they play all these movies. It's a film that we make fun of the mistakes, but we make fun of them lovingly. And yet it's such a, again, it's a simple story. It's universal about family, about code, about honor. It's a Godfather, the original Godfather, a movie that is truly something that I can watch on television anytime, and I'm going to sit down and watch it. And yeah, Godfather 2 is a great sequel, but I'm not one of those people that can pick two over one. To me, it all comes back to the first one. Very simple story about a guy who doesn't want to follow in his parent and his dad's footsteps, and through circumstances finds that he kind of has to. And he says he's not going to be the kind of man his father was, thinking his father was a thug, and that you realize over the course of the first movie, but then particularly the second one, you realize that everything his father did, he did for his family. His dad was a good guy. Michael Corleone is not a good guy. It's fascinating to see someone who is your protagonist, your hero, and yet he's doing all of these terrible fucking things. But the first one's the most fascinating because we only see the beginning of it going downhill. And like that in itself is a fascinating story. I've actually never talked about The Godfather with you, Phil.
You never have, sir. Never.
What do you think? I mean, what do you guys think? I mean, Godfather, I mean, what do we
I am one of those people who can pick two over one. It's just funny that you say that, yeah. But, I mean, there's no problem with it. I mean, what I personally love about two is the, basically the trick that I feel gets played on the audience, and it's all about empathy with the character. You know, if you have your central character, it's essential to feel empathy no matter what. And what I really love in that film is when they get into the whole court case, Michael being put on trial, Michael facing being exposed, Michael going to prison, and all of the machinations that go on, obviously, to get him out of that, to obviously deal with the witnesses. And I just found myself every step of the way being like, yeah, fuck the government. I'm with you, Michael. You go get him. You win. And, you know, obviously at the end, you know, he actually pulls it off and he is exonerated. And,
at the risk of his family.
Yeah, exactly. And yet I was like,
it's something you realize his father would have never done. You realize, like, because going through, like, particularly when you talk about two, it's like the both movies, and I never really realized that was what Coppola was going for, but both movies are about the father and the son both at 30 years old, you know, going through these two different events that lead into the organized crime and stuff, and I didn't know that they were both supposed to be 30. I didn't get that across. I never registered that until Coppola said, I guess that shows how stupid I am, which is a big surprise, but, you know, it does make you appreciate, I mean, I don't know, man, just...
I agree. I think everyone here does too. Hawken, what is your number one?
Well, right now, Phil, as I said earlier, I tend to switch between this and Blade Runner, but, you know, I've said this many times to many people about what my number one movie is, And oddly enough, there is a bit of a theme, as I noted already, two films that take place in Los Angeles. This is by coincidence. But the third one also happens to take place in Los Angeles. And no, it's not Falling Down. It's a very classic 1974's Chinatown by Roman Polanski. I would say when I first saw this, this had to have been probably in the mid to late 90s, maybe around the laser, when my dad bought a laser disc as an ill-fated move. This was probably one of the first mature movies I had ever seen. And just again with a great, score by Jerry Goldsmith, and just a great and just a fantastic story, not only about the history of Los Angeles, but just a great detective story, and just wonderfully done. And again, it's a movie that has influence on other movies. I would say this movie, you wouldn't have had a movie like L.A. Confidential without this movie. And again, it does things that that are outside the usual, noir genre. I mean, you have Jake Gitte's a successful detective. He's so successful, he's got two guys working for him. This is against the grain of the usual detective working, he's always broke. He's working in a shambling office. He's the only one there. This is a guy who he knows what's up, and he's very successful at what he does. And just the unique time period of the late 30s. Just a great, wonderful, takes its, not necessarily takes its time, it moves, but it's not, it doesn't have to beat you over the head. It's just a very, I almost would say pleasant in what it does, even though I know it deals with some very heady subject matter. And also, I just want to mention, John Huston's great work as Noah Cross in his one scene, with that voice of his, and where you later find out what he did, and just again, just it's just a fantastic piece of work, and it's certainly one of the top films of the 70s.
Lou, what is the best film ever made?
Well, of course, the best film ever made for everyone is going to be such a personal choice.
Mm. Oh yeah.
But for me, it's got to be something like if you're down in the dumps or a bit of a funk, you always have that favorite song or favorite story or favorite drink or whatever it is that you go to get yourself out of that funk and make yourself feel better. And we all know through the years that the Academies have made, with the Oscars, have made a lot of choices that many of us have disagreed with. But for me, the most egregious choice has been in 1994, that the Shawshank Redemption did not win the Best Picture that year. This is my go-to movie when I'm feeling in the dumps. It's a fairy tale for adults. It takes place in a prison, but the story is totally ridiculous if you look at it from face value. But that doesn't really matter because it's the themes and the characters and the wonderful passage of time that it does. This movie shares a connection with your second favorite movie, Phil. It has Mark Ralston, who played Private Drake in Aliens. He's one of the cons in this.
The sisters, yes.
One of the sisters. And, this movie has worked itself into the popular lexicon. Morgan Freeman's narration has become so pervasive now that it's something that's used to make fun of narrative devices used in other movies, but it's still one of the most when you hear him talking, it's about the prison life, it's one of the most evocative things. And some of the imagery, Andy Dufresne's climbing through that shithole of a sewer pipe to freedom, and then standing up and getting that baptism of rain outside, and making the break for freedom. The little things in life that we take for granted, like a bunch of guys sitting around drinking a beer on a rooftop on a hot summer day, it's all about hope. Hope is a good thing, and good things never die, as they say in the movie. So this is my go-to movie in the dumps, and it just is. It's a fantasy, but it doesn't matter because it deals with characters, and it's interesting to watch a character like Andy Dufresne, who's such a cold fish on the outside, go into prison and become a fully realized character. And the trick of it is that while he's doing that, the movie's not really about him. It's really about Red, and Red learning how to forgive himself and not hang himself at the end of the movie like the James Whitmore character did. And then, of course, that final shot on the beach, pulling back, no dialogue, just beautifully done. You know, sometimes we complain about movies going too far with their endings and giving the audience too much, but I think this was a perfect compromise between showing the audience a happy ending but not going over the top with it. So that pullback off the beach with Andy working on the boat is probably one of my favorite cinematic images of all time.
The most earned ending in cinema history, I would say. So, my number one, of course, you know, I go last because my opinion is the correct one. So what is the number one? What's the best film ever? I'm just kidding, folks. But what's
Pressure's on, buddy.
No, it's okay. But there's a very specific reason that I've chosen this film, and it is Superman the Movie. Now, what's left for me in the 5 years Jamie and I have been doing this to say about Superman the Movie? Quite a bit, actually. I've never really told this story before, but Superman the Movie is the reason that I'm sitting here right now, doing this and talking to you. I've loved a lot of movies, a lot of these blockbuster classics of the 70s and the 80s that we always talk about, but I've never been obsessed with any of them. I mean, I've seen them a billion times, but I never knew every inch of Star Wars or Raiders or anything like that. If I have one film obsession other than James Bond, it's comic book movies. Especially today, comic book movies are our modern myths. Some of the greatest, most imaginative, most entertaining stories that can be told. They're the kind of film that we have in American cinema, the one kind of film that can truly do anything, dabble in any genre, tell any kind of story, get away with any kind of outlandish nonsense, present people with the most amazing gifts as relatable human beings, present villains that are far too ridiculous for any other kind of action film and get away with it. They are pure imagination. And Superman the Movie is the progenitor of all of them. Superman was the first film that I, once I reached my teens, truly obsessed over. I watched it till I knew every inch of it. And then, I remember this very well, the very first time I ever went on the internet, I found the Superman Cinema website and I realized I knew nothing. And then I find out how this film was actually made, about the extra footage, about the real Superman 2. I discovered, for my money, the most insane and dramatic making of a film series in the history of cinema. And that's only counting the Salkind producing years, that's never minding all the stuff that happened after that with Superman Lives. And from there, I realised that not only do I love film, but I loved filmmaking. I loved reading about the production process. And that passion got me reading all sorts of books and material online and buying DVDs just to watch the documentaries, and of course staying on the web and joining Superman Cinema's forum, talking to people that I couldn't find in the real world to talk about this stuff. And, true story, someone on Superman Cinema posted a link to a video podcast from the movie blog, and it was one where those guys were talking about Superman Lives, and of course from there I joined that site. I met Jamie and Christina and Lou Hocken later on, and after many years, here we all are. So I have a lot to thank Superman the Movie for. Talking about the film itself, the reason why it's still the best of its genre is not because it's a perfect film. It isn't. The reason it works is very simple. Clarity of story. We live in a world now where it is literally impossible to make the kind of comic book movie that Superman was. We live in a world where, firstly, comic books are not niche literature, they're mainstream. And with that comes a crowd, a very vocal and opinionated crowd, and they tell people what should constitute these films and what shouldn't. We live in a time where the filmmakers always have to be thinking, it seems, two films ahead of the one that they're making. They can't just focus on one story. Things have to be introduced pointlessly sometimes, just set up for sequels. And we live in a time where if inspiration is to be drawn from the source material, it's going to come from specific issues and storylines of that comic. Well, Superman the movie was made at a time when comic books were still considered cheap junk, and not even Superman was particularly popular in the 70s. No real forum existed for rumour to get out or for angry opinion to come back and change the film. Superman the movie was a self-contained piece of work that functioned as a wonderful love letter to the character that could tell fan or non-fan everything they needed to know about why this comic has endured for decades and continues to now. And what's amazing about that is it happened by accident, not by design. I mean, initially, Superman the movie was supposed to be half a film, to be concluded in Superman 2 with a proper cliffhanger ending. And Superman the movie didn't take inspiration from a specific time in Superman comics or a specific issue. It was the perfect amalgamation of everything ever written up to that point about that character that made it work. I mean, look at every single story point in that film. The introduction of Kryptonian society, the farewell to Kal-El and the rocket ship, the destruction of Krypton, the discovery of Kal-El by the Kents and his powers, growing up as an outsider, having to leave Smallville to find his destiny, the truth of his heritage and tutelage by Jor-El in the Fortress of Solitude, the dynamic between Lois and Clark, and Jimmy and Perry, the first meeting of Superman and Lois, the introduction of Superman to the world, Lois falling in love with Superman after one night, Lex Luthor, Kryptonite, Superman's defiance of his father. That, in today's world, we're talking several films worth of material that this one is covering in 2.5 hours. And, you know, could each of these elements been developed a little bit more? Sure. Would it be necessary? No. Are each of these moments as perfect as they are? Hell yes! And can they be topped by any new cinematic incarnation of Superman? Highly doubtful. This is the kind of storytelling that is lacking in most, if not all, high-concept storytelling today. Let's make a movie that says everything that we have to say about this character. Everything that there is to say. A film that doesn't hold back. A film that doesn't need a sequel. We don't get comic book movies like that anymore, certainly. And it's an attitude that I wish we could go back to. I mean, as optimistic as I am, I don't think we will ever see the likes of Superman the movie again. Until we do, it's my favourite film. And that is it for tonight, folks. Skype held. This was meant to be. We're all here. This was wonderful. Thank you so much, everybody, for sharing.
You're welcome.
It's a blast.
I feel like this was an episode of Dr. Phil or Maury, but more tasteful.
We all got our hearts on our sleeves today.
I know. We're still in the dead zone. It ain't going away. Again, not exactly sure what next week's show is going to be, but I will tell you now, because I all know you're dying to know, we will be recording the Summer Predictions Roundup Results Show on Sunday, September the 9th, which means it will go up, I believe, on the Tuesday 11th, Wednesday the 12th, something like that. It's going to be biblical. So that's something to look forward to. That's 2 weeks away. Next week, though, well, you'll just have to wait and see. Until then, big thanks to my special guest, Captain Lou. You are a captain in a way. I'll call you a captain. Why not? Just know us. General Lou, Captain Hawken, Lieutenant Christina, Jamie. He had to go, unfortunately, but Jamie's with us in spirit. And we'll see you next week. Until then, the balcony is closed.